Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here in Jekyll and Hyde. I want to thank Martha and Fred and whoever else was on the committee for inviting me down here. I was down here once before, I think about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's just amazing how the hotel was going through some renovation at that time. And, more will be revealed, I guess, is the way that goes. And I want to thank Lorraine and Sam for knocking themselves out to pick me up down there in Jacksonville and bringing me up and keeping me well connected throughout the whole day with doing a lot of nice things. This is really a really special occasion for me because my own sponsor is here tonight with his wife and family, and that's not a usual occurrence. And we were at dinner and spending some time together this afternoon, and it came up to me some of the things that, you know, where you start from, and now to be at Jekyll Island, it just doesn't seem possible. You know, I'm a Brooklyn boy. I went to a high school where we had an obituary column, and it was like, 85% of the suicides in Brooklyn were assisted. And we used to say things like, "Hey, he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, deserved to be shot." That's when crime was really organized. It was just a different world. You say, "How far is it to the subway?" We say, "We don't know. No one's ever made it." And the bottom line is that my wife, somebody had asked me the other day about drugs, and of course, at a noontime meeting I go to, they refer to me as an alcathoris. Now, if you don't know what an alcathoris is, and please hear what I'm saying, because some people did use drugs, but I never used any drugs. I never took marijuana. I never took any prescription drugs. I have nothing against that stuff. I personally just never took it because of where I grew up. I grew up in Brooklyn. Now, there's no mafia, but if there was a mafia, it would have been in Brooklyn. And the deal is that if you sold or used drugs in my neighborhood the first time, they would bring it to your attention by opening and closing a car door on your hand, And then if you persisted in doing it a second time, we always thought you moved to Jersey because we never saw you again, it was like you just went away, And so the deal is that I just started drinking and then continued to drink. And I remember the first time my wife talked about moving to New Jersey. And I thought, I'll never see my family again. Once they move out there, they just never come back. Now, I never tell this story, but when I moved over to Jersey, I had been born and raised on the streets of Brooklyn. The only thing I knew about growing anything was the movie A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, period. I didn't know anything about growing anything. My wife came from a farming community. She wanted to move where there was land. So we eventually moved where there was about three and a half acres, this little place we bought in. And now you got to remember, I never saw anything green. I got to be such entertainment for the locals. I mean, the guy who owned the lawnmower place, when I came in and saw, his name is Potter. He might still be there, or his son will be there. But when I used to go in the store, he used to say, "Ken, before you tell us anything, let me get my son. He's with a customer right now." Because I just had those guys in stitches all the time, They sold me one of these big ride-on kind of lawnmowers. And I went out and I said, "Well, I got to do this." So I get on there, and of course I had a couple of beers, and I was just riding around. And so I called him after about an hour or so, and I said, "This thing works," because he wanted a report. I said, "This thing works. It does the thin grass real good, but the thick grass makes a lot of noise." I said, "It comes off that mower, makes this ping, ping sound." So he said, "Well, let me get my son and come on over there. That shouldn't be hearing anything like that." So he came over and they got out. That was the first time Mr. Potter saw my farming skills. He came up, he looked at me, he looked at his son, and he just started to laugh. Do you ever have anybody just laugh in your face like that? Like, you realize that you're the center of attention and you're stupid, It's like later on when police used to talk about you like you weren't dead. What do you want to do to them? I don't know. What do you want to do to them? Like, you know, hey, why don't you ask me? You know, I'll be happy to pitch in. And Mr. Potter, who was just this great old country boy, looked at me and said, Mr. Ken, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, he said, but you cut about an acre of asparagus. he said, I realize you were raised in the city. He said, but you'd be surprised how many people eat that. You know, and right now it's pretty expensive. You know, and I think it only grows like every other year or something. It doesn't even grow every year. And I said to him, okay. You know, I knew this. That was always my best look. It was all new information, but looked like, oh, yeah, I was just in the way, you know. And any time, I remember saying to him, you know, I remember calling the water company, and I said, you know, my wife said, you know, there's an awful lot of iron in this wash that we're doing. So I called the water company. The guy came out. He went down my basement. He looked at me. It was like looking at Mr. Potter all over again. You know, like, he just started to laugh. He said, sir, you got well water. You know? You don't have city water, you know? You're getting your water from an underground stream, comes right through this place, you know? He said, didn't you ever notice the well on the side of the house? You know, like... And he said, you got to put rock salt in this thing, and that's how you basically strain it. And I thought, well, you know, I thought rock salt was stuff you put on the road. The cars keep going in the snow. Well, I'll tell you, that was a great farming experience for me. And it got so that when I went into the local stores, you knew that people in town were getting used to you being there because they'd be... You always feel built up when people recognize you and they're laughing at you, you know, like, but that's the way it was at that time. I had no idea what was going on. I had absolutely no idea. And my wife was about as dead on normal as you could be. You know, she'd wake me up and say things like, there's somebody outside. I said, good, that's where they belong, outside. That's what, you know. You know, that's why we have an outside, you know, like when they come inside, give me a nudge, you know, they shouldn't be inside, you know. And the whole deal was, is that it was like, you know, I was trying to, like most alcoholics, so don't laugh too hard, like most alcoholics, I was trying to escape from a reality I wasn't in, you know. I was trying to run away, and I wasn't there, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, and I look at people today like that, you know, newcomers, sometimes old timers. You know, I have the general feeling today that if you're not confused, you just don't understand, you know, like, you know. And I watch some people now. You know, they get into all kinds of things. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, there's an old saying. It says, "Marry the spirit of an age, and you soon become a widow." And every now and again, you'll get something that will come in the AA. It will cause people to change deck chairs on the Titanic. They'll get all excited. Someone wrote a book. Someone did a survey. And it will kind of trickle through. And it will be topical at meetings for whatever, a year, 2 years, depending on the impact. And then it just goes away. You know? And it most of the time doesn't leave any remnant at all. You know? Because the people who followed that are out drinking. You know? You know, oh yeah, I'm really not one of these, I'm one of those, you know, yeah, okay, we'll see you later, when it's your turn to buy, you know, and that's basically the way it is. And every now and again, words get in AA, and you say, where did that word come from? Like, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks at length about delusion. You know, the delusion has to be smashed, driven by 100 forms of delusion. Alcoholic is a natural state is delusion. You know, and that's just the way it talks about it. About 10 years ago, the word denial snuck in. You know, that's not even in the big book, you know. And if you look up the word denial, it's much too wispy for AA, you know. It says, one who knows the truth and doesn't want to admit to it. Denial. You look up the word delusion. It says psychotic thought. Where the individual involved has no clue as to reality, you know? When you get into denial, that's like spiritual growth, you know? Like, yeah, you know? Yeah. I was psychotic. But now I'm just your basic liar, you know? Yeah. And that's the way it goes, you know? And it's a scenario where, you know, you hear these words and they don't have any relevance. Words get in the way of a lot of things. That's why we have a whole chapter. It says in the action, you know, because words can be very, very deceptive because people hear them differently and they have different meanings depending on how you were brought up. I have a thing in my refrigerator. It's called a crisper. It should definitely be called a Rada. I don't know who in the hell calls it a crisper. You put something in there, 2 weeks later, you're throwing it out. It just stinks, you know? And that's just the way it is, you know? And the other thing I know, which is probably one of the reasons I always say this at almost every place I speak, the reason I like to come out and do this is I love to hear people laugh. I love to hear people laugh because I know some things about laughter that most people don't know. First of all, you cannot laugh and think at the same time. You know? So every time you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you. You know, like, so that's it. You know, like. The other thing is this laughter produces endorphins and stuff that makes you feel real good. The more you laugh, they tell you that the best chemistry in our minds, the best drug store is in our minds, and the more you laugh, the better it is. And they list laughing right up there with jogging and sex. So if you have a gal who likes to run, and you can get her to laugh, which at my age is undressing, you know? You know? We're just doing this as part of our health maintenance, you know? And the deal is, you know, that you get to come out and do these kind of things. And I love the theme that they picked for the weekend, unity. You know, unity, if you look it up, it comes from the old Greek. It means oneness. There's oneness. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous works so well, because we have a primary purpose. We have a common solution on which we can all agree. We have words in that book that basically relate to unity. And it's all about bringing people together. And the key word for all of it is love. You know, it talks about love and tolerance. And when Bob was passing away in his final days, he talked about love and service. And how simple this program is. You know, if you know how to love, then everything else will come into focus. That's really the thing that most people just don't know how to do. That was always my deal. I knew how to be there without being there. You know, I knew how to give without loving. But you cannot love without giving. And if you look at the word sin, all sin, I don't know what sin means because it has different meaning to different people, but all sin is rooted in failure to love. And when the book talks about love and tolerance, it says love and tolerance in the 10th step. Well, the reason it throws in tolerance is because we're alcoholic and it knows we're going to judge people, so we'll use tolerance. But if you get to a point where you don't judge, then love is sufficient. And it gets real, real easy after a while. You get to have a lot of laughs, most of them on yourself. And you get to realize that everything is happening just the way it's supposed to. And that what we're doing, you know, one of the things I found out is that even though you know something, it usually doesn't change anything. You know? And asking questions, once you start asking questions, they seem to take on a life of their own. You know, they seem to gain momentum, you know? So we don't ask a whole lot of questions in our group because most of the guys are like me. They got through school totally unscarred by education. you know. And that's why we get along so well, you know, like we just get along because we don't have these big answers. I sponsor two guys that one has about a fifth grade education and the other one's a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist got about 8 months. The guy who finished about fifth grade, he says, you know, Ken, every time we set up the room on Thursday, he asks, why are we doing it this way? He says, I sure hope he's not going to do this much longer. He's real tough to work with. And the other guy says, how do you think I feel? I have all this knowledge, and some guy, you know, who thinks Moby Dick is a venereal disease, you know, he's telling me what to do, you know, like, you know. And the bottom line is that that's AA. That's typical AA stuff. You know, it doesn't matter where you start out here. It doesn't really matter what your history is. As you go along here, we get more and more into that basic stuff that the book talks about. This is a spiritual program. We suffer from a spiritual malady. You know, and when we overcome that spiritual malady, we straighten out mentally and physically. It's pretty clear to me, you know. I hear people say, I'm not too sure what God wants. Oh, come on, I'll tell you. Here, it's right here on page 133. He wants you to be happy, joyous, and free. Which part of that is confusing? Is it joyous? Happy? Which word is throwing you off? Free, you know? Which word is really giving you all that consternation, you know, like slowing you down? Well, you know, Ken, I, you know, okay, that's all right. But, you know, the rest of the book is kind of vague. Okay, yeah, let's look at this, because it is vague, you know? When going to bed at night, that's kind of vague. You know, we constructively review the day. We don't destructively review it. We constructively review it. Oh, yeah, yeah, I can see that now. Okay, and well, then you sleep. Okay. Upon awakening, you know, is this filler? I mean, does anybody read this stuff? You know, like, you know, like if not sure during the day, we pause. I mean, that's about as vague as you could be, you know, like, you know, whoa, 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 whoa. And then the big one is when agitated. Oh, yeah, oh, whoa, whoa, yeah, yeah. So, you know, you're right. You know, it is kind of vague. You know, it's kind of, you know, I'd have trouble with it myself if I were retarded. You know, like, you know, it seems to run pretty smooth, you know. The only part that we don't understand is the part we don't understand. You know, that's like all the people studying this stuff. You know, there's books in the store now. I mean, there's conventions by professional people. There's all kinds of stuff that try to figure out why we're us. And that's the only part of the book that I love to read to those professionals. That's the only part I'd read to them. It says here, I want to point this out to you, kind of clear this up, cut down a lot of that study and a lot of anguish. We'll do away with a lot of angst in one sentence. When the alcoholic drinks, something happens. Seems pretty specific to me. You know, when the alcoholic drinks, something happens. You know? Well, what is it? Well, if you're alcoholic, you may find out. You know, we suffer from a disease. It's the wildest disease. It's the only disease I know of where the person who is the carrier of the disease is totally opposed to early diagnosis. You know. You have cancer, maybe. Don't tell me. You know, I really don't want to know anything early on. You know, alcoholics are just great. You know, alcoholics are like hamsters. You know, the wheels stop. You know, the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still going. You know, like kind of just going around. And you say that's just the way we are. You know, I go to meetings with guys. They're at stoplights waiting for them to turn green. You know, like, go ahead. You can go ahead here. You know. What's the light? It's not a light, it's a stop sign. You know, like, you know, some of those guys are really, really hard to work with. But then you can refer them to the book. And the book tells you that we suffer from this spiritual malady. And when it's overcome, you straighten out mentally and physically. When you look inside the word spiritual, you'll see the word ritual. There's a ritual of getting well here. It's about, some people think that Alcoholics Anonymous is about stopping something, and it is. But it's also about starting something. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has a thrilling beginning. It says, war fever was running high in a small, That line could just as well read, now we begin our journey to God. And the rest of that book would just fall into place. Because that's what it's about. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Which means you have to find God in the moment. You know, I have a friend who, I was sharing this with somebody, he's a lawyer, he's moving to Tibet to find God. You know? And he's a bright guy. I told him, God's not adverse to indoor plumbing. He'll like you with or without dysentery, or hepatitis, people don't realize that this is where God is. God is not an absence, God is a presence. And it's in the now. And that's why I like that word now, N-O-W, because if you spell it backwards, it's one, W-O-N. When you learn to live in the now, you've won. And if you live in any place else, then we'll see you later. Hope you catch up. Alcoholics look like reality like it's a drive-by. What was that? Oh. I'm glad we didn't stop there. It looked like reality. And the bottom line is you find out that, you hear people use phrases and you wonder, where do they get this stuff? It's not in the big book. I hear people say things like, well, there's us and then there's the normal people. Watch my lips. There are no normal people. All you have to do is read the paper, look at the TV for a day. There are no normal people. Normal people are in the stores, they're buying things like mint-flavored dog biscuits. Normal people, I want my dog to have good breath, I'll put Lavoris in the toilet. There are no normal people. There just aren't, I remember back in 1990, because we have a lot of military out in our area. We have the Navy and we have the Marines and stuff. And the Gulf War. The president said when we were going to start the Gulf War. It was in TV Guide. Normal people. The president of the United States, if you don't do this, we're going to bomb you on this date. And then the TV Guide says, local programs may be blocked out due to war. Those are the normal people. I don't know about you guys, but they just don't seem all that normal to me. Everything in life seems to be paradoxical to me. You're looking over here and something comes over there and smacks you in the face and you wonder how it got there. Then you start looking that way and it comes the other way. God does bang shots just to show off. He watch this one, And alcoholics, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you have to always look comfortable, regardless of what's going on. You have to look like you know what's coming next, even when you don't have a clue. And what you're thinking comes next is so removed from reality that actually you should be, waiting for shock therapy in a treatment room or something. People say, well, what are you thinking about as a kid? How do you talk to people like that when they ask questions like that? Well, Ken, a little therapist in my mom had to send me to a therapist. What are you thinking about? Oh, no, you got to be kidding me. I'm slow, but I'm not remedial. If I tell you, I'll probably never see the light of day. I've got so much traffic, it's tailgating. I used to think things like, hey, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? How do you share that with a professional person? You're going to be with us for a little bit here. Hanging out. And God bless my mom, who loved me and was a great support system in my life. But even she used to say, drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach. You know? She used to pick up beer cans and look at them and say, I don't know what they put in this stuff that makes you act so stupid. You know, like that. You know? And the bottom line was, is, you know, we just didn't know. I used to live back in, as I said, on the farm. And I traveled at that time, and I used to come in Newark Airport, and my brothers would be waiting for me. And we'd come out of the Newark Airport, and right across the street was the Budweiser plant. And we used to look at that Budweiser plant, and my brother would look at me, and I'd look at him, and my other brother would be there, and I'd say, you know what? We haven't drank them dry, but we got them working nights, you know, like that. My son told me a couple of years ago, he said, you know, I was almost 9 years old before I realized my name wasn't Get Me One, you know, like, he said, I just couldn't live with that, Dad, you know, this was kind of confusing to me at that time. And the bottom line is that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and Packy and his family's here, they were the folks that I met, you know, like, he'll be 36 years sober at the end of this month. And if I can hang out, I'll be 30 years sober in July. And the bottom line is, he's been my sponsor the whole time. You know, I met him at probably the first meeting I went to, and he's been there for me ever since. Whenever I had anything I needed to check on or bounce something off or get cleared up, he's the guy I call. And I remember he used to have me come over to his house. My wife, in her infinite wisdom, had moved away. And Becky used to have me come over and do these heavy chores, like put out the garbage, you know, and you might as well stay for dinner, you know. And then we'd go to meetings, and these trips to meetings were like, you know, just unreal, because we had a collection of some of the world's finest minds, and we had one guy called the Fat Man, another guy called the Lung, and then we had Fast Eddie. Then we had the Grip, the Plumber. I mean, everybody had aliases, you know, like, you could have locked up that whole car and nobody would have known each other's name, you know, like, and these conversations would go on, but the thing was, in keeping with the theme somewhat of unity, is that they kept you connected. Those folks kept you connected. They kept you connected to the best things in life, which were healthy things, and they helped connect you to a family, and they kept you going to meetings. And a lot of times, you know, with newcomers today, they come in sometimes from treatment centers and stuff, and they look physically a lot better than they feel. And you can miss those folks. When I was getting sober, there was no chance of that. You know, I showed up wearing a blue wool suit, you know, in July. You know, and they kind of figured, oh, you know, he must be a first timer, you know, like, you know, and the deal was, is that they said, you know, come down front, because that's where the miracle takes place. Well, at that time, I would have loved a miracle. You know, I would have really loved a miracle. Because, you know, I had a habit of running into the police. And what they would do is they would tell you your rights as they were taking them away. It was the darndest paradox. You know, some guy's got your hands behind your back, and he's snapping these cuffs on you, saying, you have the right to remain. I never knew I had so many rights, but I couldn't go anywhere. You know, I used to say, take off the cuffs, skip the rights, let's call it even, you know, like, you know. And in our area, they had what they call consent warrants. I don't know if they have those down here, but one cop would knock at your door, and the other cop would run around to the back and yell, come in, you know. And suddenly you were dealing with somebody you didn't expect to be there, you know, like, And the reality of that is that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I started traveling to meetings with a couple of guys. And I was coming up, I had some legal problems, I don't know why, but I had some stuff coming up. And, you know, I know this doesn't sound like much here because you probably all know each other, but in our area there's a lot of folks. And I had to go before prosecutor. And the prosecutor I went before was a guy, we were going to meetings together. And he had about 90 days or so at that time. And he looked at this thing and he said, I didn't know you did this. And I said, I sure as hell didn't know you did this. You know? When we were riding around sharing, you know, this was not my deal, you know. And the bottom line of that is that we were able to work out a deal, and the officer, I mean, it was one of those stories where looking back on it, I could see the hand of God in it. Very clear, because the guy who was the arresting officer, officer who was going to handle it for the detectives, he was a guy I went to school with and played football with. And so this whole thing kind of worked out, and it kept me from going to jail again. And the bottom line of that was, you know, it seemed as though the more I did the ritual with Alcoholics Anonymous, going to meetings, working with others, it seemed like a lot of these things that I didn't know were spiritual malady, I just thought they were problems. When you're new, it's very easy to confuse symptoms with problems. You know, if I'm drunk driving and I hit a snowbank, I immediately feel that my problem is I need a lawyer, you know, and I need a tow truck, and I need a bail bondsman. I don't think in terms of what led me into that snowbank, that it was alcohol. Alcohol is not the first thing that jumped into my mind whenever I had symptoms of any problems. In fact, I was the person who, you know, nice people were coming to me all the time saying, you know, you got a drinking problem. And my one brother told me I had a drinking problem, and I always thought he had a drinking problem. And when he started telling me that, you know, it was like you're kind of losing your support, you know. And things just started happening that you can't really explain, but they started happening. Something was happening, and that something that was happening kept leading me in a direction that it seemed once I started in that direction, it was a lot easier to keep going than to try to turn around and go back or ever get started again. And the nice thing about it was at that time, you know, Packy along with a bunch of other guys would just make sure that I got to a lot of meetings. You know, I was living alone then, and I used to get to see my children every other week, and they lived down in Pennsylvania, and my wife had moved back with her mom, and it was a scenario where it seemed as though everything was like behind the dam, and if I picked up a drink, that dam would just overflow and wipe me out. But if I kept doing these other things, that dam seemed to hold up for some reason, and I just kept doing the things that were suggested. And the nice part about Alcoholics Anonymous from my perspective at that time was it was very focused. It was all on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There weren't so many side issues. In fact, there were none. You had a clear focus of the fact that this is your problem, and this is the solution, and this is how you go about implementing the solution. And there wasn't a lot of other stuff. And the nice part about that was you got to laugh a lot. And you notice that, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you might as well learn to laugh because everybody else is pretty much laughing at you, you know? You know, they're looking at you like, wow, you know? If this guy were a fight, they'd stop it, you know? Like, they'd send him to his corner because he's just that way. And you start to do the things that don't seem like they're in your nature, you know? You do those steps. And when you get into these steps, what you find out, at least my experience with them is, initially, I didn't see them as solutions to the problem. I didn't see how doing step 1, 2, and 3 was going to help me legally, financially, or any other way. It just didn't seem to correlate. And that's because I just didn't know. And when you don't know, you don't know. You know, I was over here like milk in a mouse. You know, these are all my problems. And, you know, I didn't realize that I didn't need the mouse. The mouse was totally immaterial to the reality. And yet I get caught up in that. And you can get so caught up in that that it becomes the problem, you know. And you can spend a lot of time on a symptomatic thing that really has nothing to do with anything. And in the meantime, you're going to these meetings and you're in this car and you're doing these wild things and you hang out with these crazy people and you're wondering, what is going on here? And people say, what are you doing? And you know, you don't want to say, well, you know, things are really going good. My wife left. I'm going to jail. And I'm in AA, you know, like a... You know, I don't know how it could be any better, actually, you know. And everything you said to the old timers, you know, they said, read the book. You know, having some legal problems, read the book. is there a chapter into legality, or what chapter do I read? I'll just read the book. Everything was read the book. And as I read the book, what became more and more obvious to me, and I can only talk about me, is that in the beginning of that book, the doctor's opinion, he says that if you be alcoholic, and you know, these are not easy terms to deal with, you're maladjusted. And that's one. And two is, you're in full flight from reality. Wow, I'm so glad I'm owning up to this. You know? And when you get well, or start to get well, start to do these things, you're starting to make a move into reality. And when you're not used to it, it's scary. I mean, it's scary, you know. You arrive at places and realize everybody's been in their place right along. You're the new boy on the block, you know. It's like somebody flips on the light and you get to see all the furniture in the room, you know. You say, wow, this is very, very interesting. I'm so glad we did this, you know. And the only thing that came out of that bag, that Gulf War for me, was it gave me a definition for my drinking. I now refer to myself as a Baghdad drinker. Now, if you don't know what a Baghdad drinker is, that's somebody who was bombed regularly and blacked out frequently. You know, and that's what I was. You know, and that's why I don't go back. I hear people who can tell their story, and I'm impressed. You know, they say, when I was 2 years old, when I was 6 months old, I was 2 days, you know, out of the womb, and everybody was talking to me as though I was stupid, and I can't remember that stuff, you know. I don't remember a whole lot about drinking. It was kind of like a blur, you know. It was like I was going through the windshield. I wasn't keeping track of what was on the radio, you know. I just was like, you know, that was not my deal. And that's why when people say, you know, your story, go way, way back in your story and stuff, you know. Well, I'll tell you, I just don't remember a whole lot. And the stuff I remember most vividly never happened. So it doesn't leave you a lot of material to work with. You know, it just doesn't leave you a lot of material to work with. But the thing that held me in good stead was we had some very simple literature. And that literature is what saved me, along with doing all the things that were suggested. You know, we didn't talk in our neighborhood about 12-step work. They used to just say, go put the hit on this guy. You know, when he this guy, go put the hit on him. And Packy, who is a great sponsor, very loving man, but I got to see a side of Packy that I really respected. And that is we had a guy who was having trouble staying sober, and one day Packy called me and said, we got to take this guy to the Gill. It was a Sunday. So we drove up to the Gill, and I'll only tell the story when Packy's here, never when he's not here. And this guy decided once we got there, he didn't want to go in. So Packy just popped the trunk, took out a tire iron, and he said, I'll give you a minute. This guy was like talking, and then I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, Packy said, you got about 20 seconds. And somewhere around 8 seconds, he made a conscious decision to go into that place. He said, I'm going in there, but I want you to know it has nothing to do with you. And in he went. And on the way home, I thought, all right, it is a program of attraction. You know, like it is. Sometimes it just works that way, you know. It's so exciting. It is a program of attraction. And it's an amazing thing how when that guy came out and started talking around and telling his story, he said, the reason it was different this time is because right from the beginning, I was totally committed. And the whole thing, my journey here is, you know, and Clancy, who's speaking tomorrow night, talks about perception. This whole thing breaks down to perception. It was never about what was happening. It was always about what I thought was happening. You know, I was kind of like the snail sitting on the turtle going, wee, you know. I was clueless. I was totally clueless. And the sad part about it is that my my abnormality became accepted by people who saw me go through this through in stages, and they got as sick as I did. They got as sick as I did. I mean, I would be at cocktail parties, and I was still traveling in a pretty good circle then, and I would take my shoes off because I thought I had lost my toes. And I'd be there counting my toes. And people would walk by and say, "Who's that?" "Oh, that's Kenny. He's just checking his toes." And what was totally abnormal becomes semi-accepted because people don't know what to do with you. You know, they just don't know what to do with you. You know, you come out of a blackout and you're in front of a judge and he says, "How do you plead?" "Where am I?" I was on a subway heading to a football game. Where am I? Give me a minute or two to get here. It's like people always wanted answers to things you didn't have a clue. It'd be like snagging somebody out of a seat saying, "Just what happened out there and on the veranda 10 minutes ago?" "I don't know, I was in here." "How do you plead?" "I wasn't there." "Oh, yeah, sure, yeah." And they would bring in people who saw you there. And they not only saw you, they heard you. Some would even have pictures of you leaving. And you're there trying to maintain some composure. It's about, what in the hell is going on right now? You feel like you just parachuted in from another orbit. And everybody seems to know the rules. And you don't even know the game. They're playing music and you feel like your feet are tied together. I have no idea what the beat is. And people are always looking at you. And then they start talking about you like you're not there. "Well, what do you think we should do?" "I don't know. This is not his first time doing it." And you feel like you're... I got to the place where I felt like I was no longer living my life. My life was living me. I was just riding along for the ride. I was like a sidecar on a motorcycle. Motorcycle was my life. I was just, "Hey, where are we going now?" "Hey, don't break any speed limits, You certainly don't want to get arrested again, And the bottom line was my brothers at the end would say, "Just be quiet. When you don't know, just shut up." They didn't realize how difficult that was. Because there's always a part inside of you saying, "My turn." Boom, you're there. I remember an incident where my brothers took me out drinking, and we were in Coney Island in Brooklyn. And we were drinking, and at that time the drinking age was 18, so I was maybe about 15 or 16. But I was about 5'10", 5'11 at the time. And if you're with your brothers, you could go anywhere and drink. And then they decided that we should do something for fun. But they didn't know what to do, so that meant I had to do it. So I went on to where they had the miniature golf course. And I got in the windmill. And I had a bottle of Four Roses. And every time the ball came in, I threw it back, I had that golf course looking like the 405 in the middle of traffic, Like, people couldn't get through the windmill. Ball, out it go. Finally, they realized there's some fool in there who's returning the ball, So they went and got the police, And two of New York's finest arrived on the scene, and they always look like they're like part of the donut patrol, And so I got out of there and I started to run, and I could outrun both of these guys. I was still young enough, fast enough, I could outrun both of these guys. But the one guy, as he ran to catch me, he tripped over that stuff they put along there to make sure the ball doesn't go out. And as he fell down, the windmill came around and hit his hat, and just went. Cop laying on the ground with his hat cockeyed. He looked worse than me, So I don't know why I can't run, laugh, and pee at the same time. So I was suddenly engulfed in this reality of being there, And my brothers, of course, stayed because they were going to hang out with me. And what they said is, "Look, all we have to do is appear in the morning, we'll plead guilty, we'll go home, Mom doesn't have to know anything about this." So in the morning, they had the policeman there, and he, He was a policeman at that time who felt that we owed him a uniform. He took his uniform home and I'm sure put it through a shredder. So he wanted a new pair of pants. So he was going to get a new pair of pants out of the deal. And he brought these pants in that, you know, looked like some seamstress had just tore them apart. And the judge said, "How do you plead?" My brother said, "Guilty." "How do you plead?" My other brother said, "Guilty." "How do you plead?" I said, "Please, just plead guilty. We got enough money to cover this." And I said, "I don't know how to plead." And the judge said, "Well, is he the officer or not?" I said, "I just don't know." He said, "Well, what would firm it up for you?" I said, "Can you have him put his hat to the side?" Alcoholics understand that. And they even enjoy it sometimes. It's humorous. Nobody in that court was laughing. And it cost us an extra about $125 for contempt. And we didn't have the contempt part. So my brother said, "We're with you all the way. Win or lose, you're lost, you know, like stay here." And the deal was is that's the way it was going. And then I came, my wife left, I was in the middle of this upheaval in my life, totally chaotic, and my wife said to me, "If you're smart, you'll go get help for your drinking." And I suggest Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, a lot of people had said that before, including her, but now it was like really, really serious. And I went to a meeting. And then I went to another meeting. And then they said things like, you know, if you want to get hit by the train, you got to play down by the tracks. If you want to get this thing, you got to be at the meeting, because at the meeting is where we go over the stuff that's most important. And try to be here regular. And I started doing that. And as I said, I immediately started taking the steps. And I started going on retreats. And these retreats were really valuable for me, because initially, I didn't have the money to go on these retreats. And the way they ran these retreats is that when you arrived at the retreat house where we lived, and I guess they're still going on, but the deal is that they would give you a plain white envelope. And then you'd go to your room and you'd spend the weekend there. And then when you left, you would take that plain white envelope and you'd put it in like a little basket. And the guys who were making some money, because they were sober, they would fatten up their envelope a little bit, put some extra money in. And if you could afford to put in a couple of bucks, you put in a couple of bucks. And if you couldn't afford anything, you didn't put in anything. But the thing was, is you got to go. And they never came up short money. The retreat house was always happy with what they got. And the reality was, is right from the get-go, I met people in Alcoholics Anonymous whose only concern for me was their concern for me. There was no profit motive. There was nothing in it for them. But what happened was there was something in it for them. And that is, by helping me, somehow their lives got better. Now that's one of those something happened, you know. There's really not a math formula to a lot of this stuff. You just kind of wave a hand and say something happened. And you know, I was on a retreat not too long ago, and it just happened to be one where it was mostly Eastern folks there. And they had a sign, and it said, "There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. There is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. There is no way to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the way." And while I was reading that sign, I thought of the triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the happiness that I experience today comes from the service work that I do continually. The peace that I feel today at the depth of my being comes from being in unity with my fellow man, both in AA and out of AA. And the enlightenment, the little bit that I've had a chance to experience, has come from, of all things, doing recovery. You know, if I wasn't in recovery, these things would not be happening in my life. And the bottom line for me has been, over the years, growing more and more to see what's important and what isn't important, and being able to discern between an incident and a crisis. You know, I went through a period of my life a while back where I went through a lot of people dying, and one of them was my son. And in being with my son, one of the things I noticed is that there was such a support system. Clancy knows a young man who passed away in November, Mike Finch. And Mike was a guy who died of Lou Gehrig's disease. And he's a guy who when he was dying, had that support too. All kinds of people. He used to go up to the Pacific Group every week. And to see this guy get ready to go was no easy task. He had to be tucked in. They had to put a thing around his neck. I mean, a lot had to be done for him to go to a meeting. And he went. And when he wasn't there, he had meetings in his home. And when he celebrated anniversaries, people from all over our area and from the Pacific Group came in. This group, people just supported him. His dad asked me to be his death sponsor. He wasn't in AA. He said, "You've been through this. Would you help me with this?" And his dad and I developed a rapport because his dad said, "I feel so left out." He said, "These people are so proficient. They're so supportive. They're so nice that I don't really see a purpose in my own being here." He said, "Because they're just doing so much for this kid." And the bottom line was is that I went and spoke in Virginia, I think it was around the 10th, 11th of November, and when I got back, he was already in hospice, and when I went to see him, he was in the same room my son was in. He died in the same room my son died in. And he died with the dignity of somebody who was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the impact he had on the people around him was just unbelievable. These people were awestruck with this young man who was facing such adversity and such discomfort, and yet he was practicing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in every interaction with every person. At the meeting at his house, right before he went into the hospice, they asked him what his big problem was when he was sharing, and he said, right at the door of death, "I have to be very careful because I'm very selfish at this point, and I have a capability of taking advantage of people because they want to try so much to help me." He had a wife that couldn't stay there, and she went someplace else. And when he called me, he thought he had a resentment there. I mean, you talk about enlightenment and insight and sobriety. He thought he had a resentment there. And he said, "What should I do with that, Ken?" And I said, "Well, you know, the book talks about praying about that stuff. You just pray about it and try as best you can to come to a resolution with it." And about 2 weeks later, he called back and he said, "You know what? I don't have any resentment. It's not resentment I'm feeling. It's jealousy. She can leave and I can't. She can move away from this scenario and I'm stuck with it. And so I have to see it through to the end where she gets the right to go do something else." And it was just an amazing thing. He passed away that Wednesday. I got back on a Tuesday. He passed. I got to see him that night. The next day, he passed. And all these young people used to sleep in the room, and they'd bring in videos, and they'd sit around, and it was just amazing. The unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a prayer that sometimes I hear shared at meetings, and people say, "You know, when I was going through the tough part of life, there was only one set of footprints in the sand, and that's when God was carrying me." That was not my experience, and I know in talking with Mike, that was not his experience. There were footprints all over the place. There were a lot of folks there helping. There were a lot of folks representing God who were on the scene helping. And the nice part about that is you got to see these kids just do this. And it made you feel so good to belong to something where people were so into caring for someone else without any reward for themselves. And you got to see the reality of what we go through here. We come in here as alcoholics, and we think this is about just getting sober. It seems, and if you're not sober, then it's very, very important. But after you're fortunate enough to experience some time in sobriety, now it's your time to divvy up to the bar and pay your tab. Your tab is this service work, and it's doing other things for other people. And it's growing spiritually, because in growing spiritually, you get to do God's work. And you get to have a good time doing it. I mean, I hang out with guys that collectively, you know, they could all be in county mental health. You know, they should maybe be making belts and stuff, you know. Instead, here they are doing operations, and they're lawyers, and, you know, they're operating in all these professional realms and all kinds of realms, you know. The guy who fixes my car, you know, he used to be a gangbanger, you know, and he'd be the kind of guy who would take your car. Now you turn it over to him and give him the keys, you know, and now he's like, "Oh, yeah, don't worry, he'll be here when you get back, you know." Like, you know? And that's the deal. And that's the metamorphosis, the catharsis, whatever you want to call it, of watching somebody come in here and just get into this deal and go along. And it's about a lot of laughter, you know, and it's about this love. You know, Bob Smith on his deathbed had this thing right. It's about love and service. If you can do that, those two things, in fact, if you can just love, that's the deal. When I moved, the gang back east gave me a living Bible, and I highlighted the Corinthians part of it there, where it says, you know, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. And if you get to be a great lover, you're going to have no trouble in sobriety. You're going to have no trouble at all, because you're not going to be caught up constantly with trying to rationalize a reality that never happened for you. You know, you're going to move out of that, and you're going to get a chance to grow. And you're going to get a chance to hang out with people who are just as certifiably insane as you. You know, and that's the nice part too, because you get a chance to do that. And you get a chance to laugh all the time, and then every now and again you stop laughing and you realize, I'm laughing. And there's probably not a whole lot to laugh about. You know, do you ever get yourself in such a bind that you're just sitting there and the other people around you are trying to support you and all of a sudden you all start laughing? You know, it's gotten so bad, now it's getting good. You know? You figure, it can't get any worse than this, you know? And then more will be revealed, you know? And you just get to do this thing. And you get to do a Unity Weekend here in Jekyll Island. And you get to hear a lot of speakers that come from a lot of different positions in life, because that's the way it's supposed to be. And the nice part about it is that we do have a common solution. We do have a primary purpose. You know, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And this book cuts right to the chase when it says either God is everything or God is nothing. And that's, you know, there's not too much maneuvering in there. You know, this is the deal. And it's about how people think, you know. I always remember the story of the kid who was learning math. And he was slow, very slow in math. And the teacher said to him, well, let me help you out here. Let me give you a little extra help. So she said, let's say there are 12 birds sitting on the fence over there, and I shoot 7 of them. How many will be left? And the kid said, none. She said, no, let me do that again. It's, you know, I realize it's kind of tough. There are 12 birds on the fence over there, and I shoot 7. How many are left? And the kid says, none. She said, how do you get that? He says, well, if you shot 7, the rest would fly away. And she says, you know, your math stinks, but I really like the way you think. You know? And he said, do you mind if I ask you a question? And she said, no. He said, there's 3 women coming down the street, and they all have an ice cream cone. One's licking it, one's sucking it, and one's biting it. Which one is the married one? She looks at him and she says, well, I guess the one sucking it. He said, no, the one with the wedding band, but I sure like the way you're thinking. You know, like, And if you guys can stay laughing and stay in unity with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, then we'll always like the way you're thinking. And more importantly, you'll like the way you're thinking. I want to thank you for inviting me to come here this week. Take real good care of one another. We're only on loan. God bless you.